Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The fate of the planet, the nation's health, the nation's economy, all in the headlines this week. In Copenhagen, President Obama stood before a packed hall today and said the world has a choice: rally for change and a new climate accord,
or we can choose delay, falling back into the same divisions that have stood in the way of action for years.
The White House says health care history is coming, but right here, yesterday, former DNC chairman and Vermont Governor Howard Dean said the health care reform bill has lost its way.
We certainly shouldn't vote for this bill. I'd say strip it down, keep the good stuff, and get all the insurance special interest stuff out of there, because it's not serving us well.
And Fed chief and Time Magazine's Person of the Year, Ben Bernanke, gets a committee thumbs up for another 4 years, but not from Alabama Republican Richard Shelby.
The crisis of 2008 was not days or weeks in the making. It took years, and many of those years, Chairman Bernanke supported the actions that contributed to the ultimate scale of the problems we encountered.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable, goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. What's the lesson of Copenhagen, of the healthcare home stretch, of the hackers and the predator drones? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington, D.C. is Jessica Yellen. She's national political correspondent for CNN. Jessica, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
From Dallas, Texas, we're joined by Bill McKenzie, editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News. Bill, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom. Hello.
And also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Jessica, and Bill.
No decision out of Copenhagen, or no big agreement as we speak right at this moment, but lots of voices. Let's listen to a little bit of President Obama. Air Force One came in. He went right into meetings, came out, delivered an 8-minute speech insisting America's committed to finding a solution to climate change.
America's made our choice. We have charted our course. We have made our commitments. We will do what we say. Now I believe it's the time for the nations and the people of the world to come together behind a common purpose. We are ready to get this done today. But there has to be movement on all sides to recognize that it is better for us to act than to talk.
Movement on all sides, the president insists. Hello, China. But that's not happened yet, and there are, of course, critics on all sides here. Here's Anirupama Rao, India's foreign secretary, on Wednesday saying that developed countries just haven't done the necessary to get a deal done.
From the current state of negotiations, it appears that the developed countries are not prepared for a comprehensive outcome at Copenhagen that would bind them to fulfill the commitments for emissions reduction under Kyoto Protocol and the UNFCCC.
Jessica, Bill, Jack, here we are. Jessica, first to you. What a picture. 100-plus heads of state in Copenhagen, and at this hour, no deal done. Are they going to go away empty-handed? Might we still see something emerge here, Jessica? How are you following what's going there?
Well, the White House is insistent that they're optimistic right now. The president had a meeting with the Chinese premier this morning. They say that it was productive and that they had steps forward. And they are, you know, the president broke up his schedule to go straight into discussions instead of doing some of the ceremonial efforts. And they still are hopeful that they can come away with an agreement that has actual substance in it. But it's still up in the air right now.
There's talk that this may go on through the weekend. Maybe the heads of state go home and leave their crews behind to try and get it done. Jack, as you watch this, what are you seeing unfolding in Copenhagen? It's certainly nothing like a slam dunk of a deal here. Big issues with China, transparency, and whether it's a binding commitment that they would be making.
Yes, that does seem to be a crucial issue, and I think that the president really spoke beyond his brief when he said, we will do what we say. Well, it's not clear that we will or that we can or that the Senate will let him. And the delegates certainly know that. This week, former Vice President Gore told the delegates, he said that unless we act, the next generation will look at us and say, you didn't realize that we were at stake. The trouble is, with this crushing recession, more and more people are thinking that this generation is at stake, and are fearful of the costs of really substantial action here. I see now 7 in 10 Americans say that if it comes to a trade-off between the economy and the planet, we have to pick the economy. It's a very bad time to make progress on global warming.
Brazil's President Luiz Lula da Silva, speaking also at Copenhagen today, just before President Obama, he expressed his frustration at lack of progress and said developed countries need to take greater responsibility for their actions.
It is unacceptable that the countries that are less liable for climate change will be the first ones to be their main victims. The convention has established the obligation of the developed countries to offer technological financial support for the developing countries.
Hillary Clinton talking about doing just that, maybe a $100 billion scale. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, here he is urging all the states represented in Copenhagen to seal a deal for climate change. So the time to act is now.
The time for delay and blame is over. It is time to start looking in the mirror and start offering what the member states could do.
Bill McKenzie, what should the world see when it looks in the mirror on this big meeting?
Well, I think it would see, as Jack said, and I think he was absolutely right, how difficult it is to get these things done. Now, first of all, let me say, I think we should all hope they do get something done, because I agree with Al Gore. Our kids' futures are at stake here, and so I think it's very important. But, you know, this is analogous to what we see going on in healthcare, and I guess you could also make that same argument in the deficit. We're all going to have to sacrifice something to get to this larger goal of either a cleaner environment or controlling healthcare cost or controlling the deficit. And that's not easy. And our part of it is, you know, we as Americans are going to have to show a greater willingness to sacrifice. And I think, second, it requires our political leaders to be able to lead us down this path. And generally, they're not doing it. And the last thought I've had on this is, and this is going to politicize it, I'm sorry, but, you know, when President Obama was running as a candidate, it often seemed like when he was talking, you know, look, we can really do these things here. We can go do these things. And if you just got Bush out of the way, everything would be copacetic. Well, you know, we're here in Denmark, or he's there in Denmark. Mm-hmm. It is very difficult to get this stuff done. Let me be clear. I hope they do get something done, but it is very difficult because it's going to require people to change their lives.
Let's get a call right here from Mike in Brattleboro, Vermont. Mike, you're on the air. What do you see, sir?
Well, I just see another major boondoggle of waste and, you know, no thought for the world when these people get together at the last minute. And it's always this hurry, hurry politics. One knows it's not going to happen in the short time. You know, this country is just too involved with mass manufacturing whatever's left to make any amends. It's just not going to happen. And it, to me, it just appears that, you know, I voted for President Obama, and he's kind of pulling all these pieces together, even caving in to Lieberman under the health public option plan, which he said he would vote for. So it just seems to be a mass destruction of immobility. It's just this hurry-hurry that just doesn't seem to make sense.
Hurry-hurry, but then a kind of immobilization, as you say. Jessica Yellen, President Obama was in Copenhagen just, 11 weeks ago or so, wanting to bring the Olympics for Chicago. That didn't happen. What about this time? He and the Secretary of State are talking big, but he may not come home with anything here.
Are you suggesting he has some political capital on the line here?
Yeah, maybe.
It would be more than awkward for him to come back from Copenhagen empty-handed. And I think it's fair to say that he won't. They'll come back with something because other nations are even conscious of this and trying to give him something. The president did go out on a limb here. He decided initially he was going to go to Copenhagen at the beginning of the meeting so that he didn't have to produce a deliverable at the end. He pushed it back so that he really does have the pressure on. He's there to be the deal closer. And that is why, you know, I'm getting emails from the White House right now. They're constantly updating with the president's new schedule, more multilateral talks, making the point that he is doing what he can to pressure everyone involved to come home with some sort of, you know, with something substantive. But the problem here for the president is he's both trying to be as effective as possible. He's trying to take the risk. This was a political risk for him to do it now.
To
so he put some capital on the line doing this. And he's in this tight spot where his intentions are to be as forward-thinking as possible here. But you got to wonder if it was the wrong strategy for him politically, because you can imagine what the pundits are going to be saying no matter what he comes home with now. It's a really awkward position for the president politically.
On the other hand, if indeed you have a planet in peril, which is the message again and again out of Copenhagen, not everybody buys it as we sometimes hear, but the scientists overwhelmingly do, and the heads of state in Copenhagen certainly overwhelmingly do. I mean, the president of the United States can hardly walk away from that, Jessica. That's a fire burning.
Absolutely, and he vowed to do it. And let's look also at his domestic politics. His liberal base, his progressive base, needs something from him. So, you know, he hasn't given gays in the military. He hasn't done there's not going to be a public option in healthcare reform. There are a number of issues where he's not moving to the left. Here's an issue where he really can deliver. He has done it with regulations at the EPA. So the U.S. will act unilaterally on that front no matter what happens with legislation in Congress. So he believes and he has political motivation to be there fighting for this. But I will point out, you know, the Washington Post this morning has a new poll out saying that 57% of Americans oppose this new fund that the U.S. is going to contribute to help other nations, developing nations, reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. So it's not necessarily politically popular broadly. It's popular with his base.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, a cliffhanger in Copenhagen healthcare, holdouts, insurgents hacking American drones. Bill McKenzie is with us from the Dallas Morning News. Jessica Yellen, national political correspondent for CNN, is here. And our own Jack Beatty, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, squeaked into Copenhagen just before the president and made headlines on Thursday when she laid out a financial incentive to get a climate deal done, saying the U.S. would participate in a $100 billion annual fund to assist developing countries by 2020 if a compromise is reached.
$100 billion a year is a lot of money. That's a commitment that is very real and can have tangible effects. So we actually think $100 billion is appropriate, usable, and will be effective.
In 2020, if, she said, everybody comes in committed, if, she said, everybody comes in transparent. China is so far not so willing to do that, and 2020 is far away. Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Dennis, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a couple of comments.
Yes, sir.
One of them is on the global warming, the summit going on over here. In Copenhagen. We have a lot of people over there seem to be all concerned about their own agendas and their own conditions and what they want and what they'll accept and what they won't accept. And none of them seem to be boiling this down to the bottom line. And the bottom line is global warming is going to destroy this planet. And we can either have a place to live or not.
And, it's a rough bottom line. Your second point, Dennis?
And my second point is on this health care issue, the same kind of stuff is going on. It's all this inviting, and I'm so disappointed in Joe Lieberman. But anyway, the point is that nobody that I've heard has said anything about the one main issue, the one main thing, the one main thrust about this health care bill is that we're talking about human beings. We're talking about people's lives.
Dennis, you've got your eye on the bottom line, and I appreciate that on both counts, and we'll come to both. Let me get one more call here first, if I may. Iowa City. Thank you, Dennis. Jim in Iowa City, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. Your people are keep talking about President Obama this and President Obama that. He doesn't make the laws. It's the Senate and the House that have to act. And the Senate and the House, you have the Republicans who act as a block against anything the Democrats are for. And to get the Democrats to go in one direction is like herding kittens. If we want to get anything done in this country, the first thing we have to do is campaign finance reform, where all of these gentlemen are not looking at their own self-interest on how to get money so they can get reelected.
Jim, we've got it. So maybe lay off the president a little, and let's look at Congress here. Of course, there are leadership issues at the same time.
Bill McKenzie, let's take both of these. I mean, it's a big both. It's the planet's climate and it's American health care. These are about as big as they get. But what do you think of Obama leadership on these two? And what about our caller's point? You know, Congress is there with all of its own divisions and interests.
Right. Well, first, I think you have to admire Obama for wanting to take on some of these big issues. And they need to be dealt with. And so, you know, I go back to what I said when Jack was talking a little while ago. We are just going to have – there's an opportunity cost to all this progress that we're trying to make. At some point, we as Americans are going to have to either pay the price, change our lives, however you want to put it, mm-hmm. to make some of these things happen. Let's look at the health care bill a second. You know, I'm very ambivalent on it, and frankly, I think if I were in their shoes, I'd probably vote against it for this reason. Not that it isn't good to cover more people, not that it isn't good to take care of pre-existing conditions, not that it isn't good to give portability of health care. All of that is very important. Mm-hmm. It's good that we're going to create subsidies to help people of low income go buy health insurance. No problem with any of that. But here's the problem, is that we're looking at the financing of these two House and Senate bills that are about half of the financing comes from reductions in Medicare. And, you know, you look at Congress's track record over the last 10, 12 years since the 1997 Balanced Budget Amendment, but Balanced Budget Act, Congress has never been willing to sustain cuts to Medicare. So what's going to happen 5, 6, 7 years down the road if Congress looks up and says, well, you know, we really aren't going to cut Medicare by $460 billion or $495 billion as it is in the Senate bill? We're going to have a big hole there. So, you know, we're going to exacerbate the deficit. And, you know, that's the type of issue that – would get me to think twice about voting for this bill. But I guess back to your original question about Obama and his leadership. Very quickly, I go back to what Jessica said. You know, he has to appease his liberal base. I would argue, look, you know, he took health care as a major issue this year. That was something they wanted. You look back at Clinton in 93, he put health care off a year and he went with the deficit to take care of the moderate conservatives. I would argue that was the right strategy for at that point for Clinton. You also look at Obama, you know, that stimulus package, $800 billion basically at the beginning of the year. No argument we needed a big bang, but they basically gave it over to the House Democrats who open up their medicine chest, if you will, and put all the spending ideas that stored in there for years and said, here, go do this stuff.
Jack, how do you see the leadership question around President Obama? We'll come to the details on health care, but here he's got Copenhagen. He's there right now, you know, standing in front of the world saying, let's do it. On the other hand, is the U.S. really ready to step up? And then there's health care where he kind of passed it to Congress for the year. How's this head of state doing?
I would not give him a B+ on leadership. He gave himself that.
This week.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. I mean, to me, the paradox of the president is he's superbly well-gifted at the outside game, at the speech, at framing things, at convincing people in the large. And yet, in both these instances, the climate change and the healthcare, he's worked inside. It's all been inside, all processed, the way a 19th century president would do. Give it over to Congress, and there's been a strange passivity from the president at crucial moments where, you know, do they really want the public option or not? Was he really to put some pressure on these people or not? And I'm just not sure what that says. It's clear they wanted a deal and they wanted to be able to sign a piece of legislation. What's not clear to me is that they wanted the right deal or that the president was willing to spend capital within his own party. By you know, we had a caller raise the issue of campaign finance by pointing out to what these senators were being paid, by actually saying to independent voters out there, folks, I'm with you. These guys are on the tab. Here's what this guy's taking. Here's what that guy's taking. Boy, that would be something to really take on these senators. He didn't do it. So I have felt that his goals are right, but his methods, his strategy has seemed to me to be lacking in oomph.
Jessica Yellen, our caller, says, look at Congress. On the other hand, for the first time this week, we have opinion polls here, NBC opinion poll showing the president's approval rating dipping below 50% for the first time in his presidency. You're in Washington. What do you see, whether it's health care or climate? What's the opinion unfolding there of the president's leadership style?
Well, there's a lot of frustration. Look, I would make the first point that this is the first year of a presidency, and in every first year, it's like watching somebody walk on ice with a pair of shoes on without ice skates, right? Mm-hmm. It's just awkward. They don't know exactly how to respond, and we've seen it with, you know, endless series of presidents. This White House, their response to all this is, it's not the process that matters, it's the result, that we become too obsessed with watching the incremental moves, and it's all ugly, and it shouldn't matter, because once they get something done and they're confident they will, people will see the effects of it, be pleased, and wins beget more wins. So if they win on health care, that gives win behind the sales to win on climate, to win on what they're going to take on next, financial reform, et cetera. My personal analysis is that they did, in fact, overlearn the lesson of Clinton years. And there's so many Clinton folks in there who were burned by that inside the White House that they really did hand the reins to the to Congress too much. First, with the stimulus package, by giving them so much control over the stimulus package, it organized the Republicans against the Democrats in a way that nobody foresaw at the time. I mean, Republicans were panicked about how to take on Barack Obama. He was so popular. And then suddenly, the stimulus package came along that was so unexpected and unwieldy and unpopular. It gave the Republicans this momentum that's carried them through all these fights to this very day. So that was a key miscalculation that has hurt the White House, I would argue, to this moment. And they're dealing with the effects of it. But again, they're confident, they're certain that we're too myopic, and this will all be moot as soon as health care is done.
Done with a win. Of course, what is a win is the question. On Wednesday, you had Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders on the floor of the Senate proposing a single-payer amendment to the health care bill. He said he knew it wouldn't pass, but he was raising the flag anyway.
I will be offering on the floor of the Senate, I believe for the first time in history, a national single-payer program. And I look forward to getting a vote on that. I am not naive. I know that we will lose that vote.
So that won't be a win. But then you had Joe Lieberman with a kind of win, a one-man, one-senator win. Here he is Monday telling reporters that he thought the foundation of Senator Harry Reid's health care bill was a good bill. He thought it needed some help with stripping it of some of its excess.
I've been focused on trying to get it back to its strong core and take off some of the stuff that runs the risk of creating federal debt, moves toward a government takeover of insurance, which I think would be bad
for. So you think they can work this out?
I'm hopeful.
Can work it out. Joe Lieberman put his stamp on it. No public option, no expansion of Medicare, period. David in Somerville, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
Very well. What do you see?
I wanted to put a question to Jack.
Mm-hmm.
I was at a local chapter of the Obama organization a couple nights ago, and I would say that it was you're looking at a very upset group of people. They're torn between wanting to still believe and be loyal to him and give him the support he needs, and I would say a small minority, including myself, is ready to look for a new candidate for next election.
Wow.
What do you think that, really disappointed lefties like myself should be doing at this time? Should we be revoked, or should we be supporting him in a particular kind of way?
David, we've got it. Jack, take it and start, if you would, with the health care question in particular. Yay or nay?
I think David is emblematic. According to a Washington Post poll today, 56% of Republicans are highly interested in the 2010 election, only 46% of Democrats. There's a passion gap developing toward November with, as Jessica's mentioned, and Bill too, a turned off, or at least a somewhat dimmer Democratic base. But this issue of health care, if one just steps back from a minute and just looks at what Dennis, our earlier caller, raised, 30 million people are going to have health insurance who don't have it now. According to a Harvard study, 40,000 people a year die because they don't have health insurance. That's a moral disgrace. That will end through $900 billion in subsidies to people to buy insurance. And you know, when you start to look at the numbers, I mean, the case is so overwhelming. Nate Silver, the mathematical genius who runs 538, using CBO numbers, calculates that status quo, a family earning $50,000, family of four, by the year 2016, we'd be paying about $20,000 a year. This is in the self-insurance market. Under the Senate bill, their premiums would be about $4,000 a year. My God, they'd be practically working for health care in just that alone with the status quo, and they can have a decent life and health care under the Senate bill. That's a gain for the social good, it seems to me.
So, and progressive yelping aside, you're going to say, if President Obama gets that, you're going to say a win.
It's an immense win, and if once we step back from the details, which are so umbrageous, I mean, Joe Lieberman, all the rest, and just look at the big picture, it's an immense victory for the idea of the good society.
Jessica Yellen, do you agree, as the president, if he gets it, and first of all, do you think he's going to have it by Christmas, a health care reform bill, or shortly thereafter? And if he does this go in the win category for him with all of the compromises that have been made?
Well, I'll take on if he's getting it by Christmas. This is the most popular topic of discussion at the holiday parties I've been to this week.
Imagine.
You know, everybody's analyzing, how do you wrangle everybody by Christmas Eve? The analysis is that everyone's divided. Some people think that the deadline ticking, the clock ticking, will force action. We've seen members just vote to get home before. But the likelihood is that they'll still have to come back on the 26th or 27th to take up any number of other issues. And I do think, on the larger point, the president will get something that he can call health care reform. It will have enough elements in it that are Democratic elements that can please the Democratic Party, not for 2010, but for 2012. So politically, it can turn into a win for him. I do think that it will be used as a bludgeon against Democrats effectively in the 2010 campaign, most likely.
And there's still this lurking out there. Here's Senator Ben Nelson, Democrat, Nebraska, yesterday talking about health care legislation on Nebraska's radio station KLIN, saying the bill reflects some, in his view, positive changes. But at the same time, he said because of the bill's language on abortion, he still couldn't vote for it.
They've added some, important things, funding for teenage pregnancy as an alternative to abortion. They've offered to increase the tax benefit to make it a refundable tax credit and increase it for adoption so that lower-income people are in a position to adopt. So there's a lot of improvement on the legislation, but the basic question about funding of abortion has not been fully answered yet.
Bill McKenzie, could this still trip up on the abortion question that's come back again and again now?
Yeah, and I'd really kind of hate to see that, because abortion is so minute in this debate. And in all due respect to Senator Nelson, I know it's an important issue to him. I know it's an important issue to some of his constituents, and he has to figure out what's best for him. I understand that. But, you know, the amount of attention that's starting to be paid to abortion in the midst of this kind of bugs me, because it really isn't the central issue. I'd like to go back to something Jack said, if I could, just a second, because he's talking about the idea of a good society. And I subscribe to all that. And if we're operating in a vacuum and we're only dealing with the here and now, of course we'd want to do these things. It would be the moral thing to do. But as we've talked on the show many times before, what are we passing off to our future generations in terms of cost through the debt, which is at $12 trillion? I did a conference call this week with the Peterson Foundation out of New York. They've done yet another study looking at the House and Senate bills. And while there are many things they say nice in here, it doesn't really bend the cost curve. It helps a little bit with Medicare through these cuts I talked about, but it really doesn't do for the larger population. That's going to be a problem going forward.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And in other news this week, just as the H1N1 vaccine became more widely available, the CDC recalls some of the vaccine intended for children aged 6 months to 3 years. It was, they said, too weak.
Health officials are recalling 800,000 doses of H1N1 vaccine, the recalled vaccine manufactured by Sanofi Pasteur.
Famed televangelist Oral Roberts died Tuesday from complications of pneumonia in Newport Beach, California. He was 91 and did not mince words.
What God wants is people with faith,
What God wants is people who are willing to suffer.
And just yesterday, the funny family of Springfield, Homer, Marge, Bart, Lisa, Maggie, The Simpsons, marked their 20th anniversary on air.
Hello?
Marge, this may be hard to believe, but I'm trapped inside two vending machines.
Sure, Homer. Trapped in vending machines. Okay.
At least we can count on Homer. We're looking at a week in the news. The cliffhanger in Copenhagen healthcare holdouts. Insurgents hacking American drones, we're told. Jessica Yellen with CNN is here. Bill McKenzie from the Dallas Morning News and our own Jack Beatty. A little more on the healthcare front here. DeWitt, Iowa. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I was just wondering something I haven't heard much discussion about. But why do we hear all the talk about reconciliation or the 60 votes? Why won't the Democrats just take the 54, 55 votes, whatever it is, and call the Republicans bluff and let them filibuster, maybe go on the offensive a little bit where the American people see that it's Republicans that are blocking this? Why isn't that discussed more?
We'll look at it, Jessica Yellen. Sort of two options there. Go to reconciliation and just bullet through with 51 votes, as George Bush did on his big tax cut packages, or I guess Steve is suggesting, you know, let the Republicans filibuster it and see who wins that showdown. What do you say, Jessica?
The bottom line is Harry Reid, who runs the Senate, doesn't want to do the 50 votes. He wants to get 60. He wants to show that there was overwhelming support in some way for this package. And leadership is leadership. So they're barreling forward with their current strategy. And there's always that the option to default to 50 at some point, but he's quite a stubborn person, and Harry Reid's psychology is inexplicable. He wants this to be a win by 60. Period.
Bill McKenzie, who do you think would win if the Democrats just stuck to their guns on what they want in the package and fall short of 60, and the Republicans filibuster? Would that be a win for the GOP, Bill?
Well, I think probably what is part of Reid's calculus, and I don't know, is that he wants enough votes to send a signal to the House, which has a little bit different take in some areas. That look, you know, I got 60 folks who support these reforms, and they you saw how hard it was to get to 60, and so you're going to have to kind of come our way some. So I think that's probably part of his calculus. I think the Republicans have been horrible on their critique of this bill. There is an absolute legitimate critique to be made about the long-term cost control aspect of it. I listen to the debate a lot on C-SPAN. You know, occasionally you'll find Republicans going up there to make some really good points. But, you know, then they go to say, look, we shouldn't do anything about Medicare, when they know full well that we can't get from here to there in terms of entitlement reform without doing something about Medicare. So I find that is just really awful, the way they've gone out and done that. You know, McCain occasionally will give floor speeches where he'll give a really good critique of how much this is going to cost and why it's not adequately financed and it's going to have a hole in it. And yet then again, he turns around and says, offers these amendments to take Medicare off the table. So I think they have blown a chance for a very good critique of it.
Let's get a call from Narragansett, Rhode Island. Pete, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I wanted to call and just I needed to tell somebody of the incredible impotent rage and disillusionment and disappointment and just crushing depression that I feel about the Democrats' inability to do anything with a majority. I don't understand why they have to put a 2,000-page bill out there and throw everything in the same. Why can't they legislate the individual components of the bill individually, put them out there, let the Republicans vote no on them, let the country see what kind of villains they are? You know how hard it is for me? Twice a week, I Rush Limbaugh for about 5 minutes just to hear what he's saying. Yesterday, he was gloating and chortling, and I couldn't disagree with him. And you know how crushing that is? That it's just, it's horrible. You know, and I want to scream, and I want to throw things at my rib,
Pete, we got it. We hear the cry. Jack Beatty, what do you say? Pete, you know, saw the victory at the polls, but doesn't see it in legislation, and you hear his impotent rage, as he puts it.
Well, what's he going to say if by Christmas or by January 15th this bill passes and we have this great advance of the welfare state? Let's face it. This is in the direction of European social democracy. Is that going to content him or not? I mean, yes, the process is just infuriating. There's no question about it. But take this issue just of reconciliation. I mean, in Reid's defense, if you do reconciliation, you can only deal with the money parts of it, the budget parts of it, in a separate bill, and you leave the insurance reforms and all the rest off the table. They have to be done in separate bills. Now, maybe Peter's right. They could be done in a series of separate bills, but that is a very messy procedure indeed. And who knows what would happen to a coalition if you did it discreetly like that, bill by bill. So yes, you can handle a budget or taxes with reconciliation. That's what it's set up for, but not for something so complicated as this.
Please, Jessica.
May I just add, he would also be lambasted for forcing such a major change in the American economy through Congress with the narrowest of majorities. So there would be political fallout for the Democrats were he to go with reconciliation.
Did Republicans take heat for pushing through the Bush tax cuts in that manner?
Well, they did ultimately. I mean, I think, you know, they may not have at the moment, but I think over time, the argument that Democrats are being bullies and tone deaf and forcing this major change through would penetrate given where the Republicans are, given that their Republicans are so consistently opposed to every piece of legislation that the Democrats have. It would just be another arrow in their quiver to argue that the Democrats aren't playing democratically.
Let's pull the curtain back here a little bit. We've got people calling in on the bigger economy, and heaven knows that's hardly in perfect shape yet. Tom in Burlington, Vermont. Tom, you're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call, Tom. I lost my job on 19th, 7 months ago, and I used to call into your show. I was Tom from Columbus, Georgia.
Yes.
And then after living out of savings for 6 months, I had to give up my apartment, so I moved back to Cookeville, Tennessee. Hometown. So then I called on your show and I became Tom from Cookeville, and this morning I'm up in Burlington, Vermont, so I'm Tom from Burlington this morning calling in.
Are you looking for work there, Tom, or what's pushed you on your travels?
That's what I've done after 6 months of calling on the phone and looking over the internet and contacting more than 100 companies. I decided to take the show on the road. I'm a craftsman. I build furniture and entry doors and mantles and stairs and things like that. And I simply couldn't find any work at all, so I thought maybe showing up in person would make the difference.
So where are you living now, Tom?
Right now I'm living in the back of my vehicle. I left Tennessee on Saturday. I got to Burlington on Sunday. It has snowed every day since I've been here. It was 0 degrees last night, and I had a frozen banana for breakfast this morning. I've got one decent lead right now, but I'm still going to look around for a couple more days before I head back south, back to Tennessee. So I can tell you from my standpoint, at least for the sake of the craftsmen out there, that industry has been hit hard and just about wiped out. Nobody seems to be able to hire or want to hire anybody.
Tom, we're going to pick up the big economy question, but I don't want to lose your case. A frozen banana in the back of your car is no way to live. After you hang up, give some kind of contact to my producer here. And if anybody in Burlington, Vermont needs to hire a craftsman, we'll try and hook you up with them. Good luck to you, Tom. Thank you for calling in. Stick with Tom there. Get his number. Bill McKenzie, there's a first-hand report on our economy if you ever want to hear one.
Wow. I'm kind of speechless. We're showing some signs of improvement. Obviously, it's not affecting Tom. Obviously, we're not, out of the woods yet. I think that maybe the question on the table is, do we need another stimulus package? And in all due respect to Tom, I'm not quite there to say we need to do something. If we were to vote on just extending unemployment benefits for another period of time, and I think the cost of that was $100 billion, if we could just vote on that, I'd do it tomorrow in a heartbeat, to help people like Tom. But, the Obama put on the table some tax cuts the other day, some more spending increases, You know, I'd still like to give it another 2 or 3 months to see whether, because we really haven't seen the full effect of this original stimulus bill.
It's cold in the back of that car, though. Jessica Yellen, there was some movement in Washington this week on a jobs package. What was that?
Right. The House of Representatives voted in $150 billion plus jobs bill. But then it broke for the holiday and leaves it to the Senate. The Senate is not going to act on that before the new year. This is the issue I follow most closely. I mean, the issues that are left undone, a new jobs bill, which will be – there will be enormous pressure on Democrats to do something on that in the new year. So they won't call it a stimulus but expect something that will be a stimulus by another name. Financial reform, which is directly impacts all these issues. Extension of unemployment benefits. The House did vote that in temporarily. Also an extension of COBRA, you know, extended medical care. The issue I also looked up this week, if I can just make the point, for a savings account, the disparity in what people are getting with their banks, for a savings account, if you were to put your money in savings, you're getting an average 0.25% interest in it. Wow. If you were to take out a credit card, you're expected to pay your bank at least 11.5% interest.
That's a spread.
This is the disparity that we're seeing out there that demands some sort of financial reform quickly that Congress has put off until the new year.
And might they do? I mean, what do you do about that? Tell the banks they've got to lower their credit card ratings? Can you demand they pay more on savings accounts?
What you can do is get a Federal Reserve that's more aggressive in terms of the way they handle the banks, the way the amount of cheap money they're giving banks and the strings that are attached to the cheap money that the Fed is giving the banks. Over $1 trillion in cheap loans that has gone out this year to help the banks, and people aren't feeling it on Main Street. And it really is true. It sounds like rhetoric, but it's true. And government regulators have the ability to make a difference that just hasn't really taken effect yet.
Let's hear from Nancy Pelosi here, House Speaker, on the jobs front. I can't get Craftsman Tom in Burlington off our minds here. Here she is in a Thursday press conference, Capitol Hill, saying Congress has done a good job of stemming unemployment with the stimulus package.
Because of our recovery package and other actions of Congress and the leadership of President Barack Obama in this last month, the economy lost 11,000 jobs, 740 a year ago. 11,000 last month. We don't want to lose any jobs. Now we are going on a path of creating a net gain of many more jobs.
740, as in 740,000 lost a year ago, just 11,000 in the unit she was looking at. But Jack Beatty, you know, we've heard this week we need hundreds of thousands of new jobs created per month to head back toward decent employment levels in this country.
Yes, and we may be heading to a new equilibrium. You know, economists talk about that. There can be a sub-optimum equilibrium, a kind of long-term chronic unemployment of which Tom was the poignant voice, a man traveling thousands of miles looking for economic opportunity, living in his car, willing to work and finding no job. Tom is not only the voice of American distress, he's the voice of the deficit. For every percentage in unemployment, that's a $200 billion hit on the deficit. If you cut unemployment in half, the deficit is in half. I mean, that's what our priority should be. And I agree with Bill. We have to consider our long-term finances. But pressingly, humanly, imperatively, we've got to deal with this unemployment situation through a jobs bill. And I think, frankly, the president has got to is going to be forced eventually to step up to something more like a WPA. Get people to work right away doing something so their dignity can be saved.
Tom, you're going to be in our minds every day right here, and we wish you luck there. A story that caught everybody's eye this week was the insurgents hacking into U.S. Predator drones. Wall Street Journal, page one story, saying militants in Iraq have used $26 off-the-shelf software to intercept live video feeds from U.S. Predator drones, potentially providing them with information they need to evade or monitor U.S. military operations. That was something to read. What an idea. And the notion was, the journal reports, that adversaries have also intercepted drone video feeds, they write, in Afghanistan, according to some, I guess, in the Pentagon. That sounded pretty wild. We've got a caller in Ovid, New York, on exactly that front. John, you're on the air, John.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to say that I think the story is way overblown. I actually worked on one of these programs in Iraq, and the fact is the video signals aren't scrambled coming out of the planes, and it's no more of a hack, you know, the way it's been portrayed, than it would be to put up an antenna and buy a you know, a scanner at Radio Shack and listen to your local police broadcast.
But, John, let me ask you. I mean, the journal's reporting this was just last summer, 09. It says the military found days and days, hours and hours of proof that the feeds were intercepted and shared among multiple extremist groups. I mean, wouldn't it be an advantage to be able to look down and see what the drone can see, see how they're what they're tracking and how they're doing it?
Well, it may be, but the point is, it's an advantage for the bank robber to listen to the local police scanner. Anybody can do it. It's not a hack. You know, that's the way it's being portrayed, that these guys were brilliant. And the fact is, it's no more brilliant than listening to your local FM radio station.
We take your point.
I don't think the planning was well. It was well done as far as how the video feeds are sent from the planes down to the ground.
And they're changing that now. John, thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, I mean, here is an example, though. You know, all the technical might of the U.S. military deployed over Iraq or Afghanistan, and what do you know? The guys down in the caves are watching through our own cameras.
Asymmetrical warfare, courtesy of the Radio Shack. I mean, it really, what a picture.
Yeah, it sure is. And what a week. We'll be watching Copenhagen as it wraps up. We'll be looking at that next week for the follow-up. Healthcare running right up to that Christmas deadline that the president has set as well. Grateful to each of you for being with us today to help us look out and look ahead. Jessica Yellen, national political correspondent with CNN. You're great. Thank you very much for joining us, Jessica.
Thanks so much. This was fun.
Bill McKenzie with the Dallas Morning News. We wish you good holidays, and thanks for being here today, Bill.
Thank you, Tom, and happy holidays to all of you.
Jack Beatty, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.